KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It's unfortunate because of the circumstances, but it's interesting that I can pinpoint the exact moment that I became a filmmaker and that this became a documentary.
In 2008, Rudy Valdez was working low-level production jobs to get by. Seemingly out of the blue, his sister, married, pregnant, and the mother of two little girls, got a stiff mandatory jail term on charges related to years-old drug crimes committed by her ex-boyfriend. And Valdez's career suddenly came into focus. Valdez tells us about becoming a filmmaker after setting out to document the lives of his sister's kids, precious years she was missing in prison. At the same time, he used his family's trauma to show the injustice of mandatory sentencing policies. His film, The Sentence, won a big award at Sundance this year and Bows this month on HBO. But first on the news banter, the Me Too movement 1 year later. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So it's just about the one-year anniversary of the two exposés, one in the New York Times, one in the New Yorker, about Harvey Weinstein. And as we well remember, the floodgates opened. We at The Hollywood Reporter were instantly overwhelmed with people calling with other Time's Up Me Too stories. Multiple stories were written. And a year later, you know, looking around, I'd say the report card is kind of mixed.
I think it's worth starting with noting some of the positive movement that has happened over the past year. I mean, a number of people who had had these stories that they had not told for many, many years felt a freedom that they had never felt before to tell those stories. And media outlets that had not reported on this stuff started all of a sudden reporting on it, including us and many, many others. So that's a good thing. A number of people who had committed this alleged behavior were outed. Many of them were purged from the industry. Again, a great thing. And there have been a number of industry-wide changes that I think are worth noting, including the launch of the Time's Up movement, which is a specific women's defense fund that has been empowered and funded to back cases on behalf of women inside the entertainment industry and, more importantly, outside the entertainment industry. There was a piece in the Hollywood Reporter this week from the president of SAG-AFTRA, the actors union, that noted some of the changes that they have pushed for, including banning business meetings in hotel rooms. They have pushed for greater oversight and reporting of incidents so that you can do so anonymously on movie sets. And I think the general tone and culture at studios, agencies, all over Hollywood is there is a renewed attention on these issues because people want to be on the right side of this issue.
Yeah. And at the same time, we see weird inconsistencies and we see, of course, a lot of fear. This is an industry that has always been based on fear and, you know, people with a lot of power concentrated in their hands. And that is an open invitation for many people to abuse the power. You know, we've seen some mixed examples. This veteran CBS producer, Brad Kern, was fired finally this past week. He was an NCIS New Orleans producer. There were multiple HR investigations of this guy, multiple complaints of all sorts of harassing behavior and retaliation and racially insensitive remarks, the kind of behavior that you would think just wouldn't be brooked anymore. And he was finally let go. And a CBS executive who worked in late night was placed on leave after an expose about his alleged misconduct. And I will say to the credit of Stephen Colbert that he not only said he was glad that story had been written, but, you know, when the single biggest name in terms of Fortune 500 company executive Leslie Moonves went under the gun for this kind of alleged behavior, Les Moonves hired Colbert, and Colbert spoke out with total clarity that he did not consider this to be acceptable behavior. So he's been very decent about that. Meanwhile, an ABC-produced show that also airs on CBS, this Criminal Minds director of photography, when he had multiple complaints, groping male staffers, threatening them physically, firing whoever complained. This was reported. This is a Disney operation. Nothing seems to have happened. It's sort of inexplicable. Disney also kind of dragged out the John Lasseter stuff after we reported allegations against him and said they were putting him on sabbatical and let it was going to be 6 months and didn't really just pull up the Band-Aid and say he wasn't coming back until the bitter end and fought it every step of the way.
Yeah, and that's where we are right now, is that these companies are put in the position where they're having to evaluate these claims that are being made about employees or clients in certain instances with talent agencies, and they're having to make a decision. And the way they're doing it is they are, for the most part, conducting internal investigations, hiring outside counsel at some times, not hiring outside counsel at other times. That's controversial. And they're having to make a decision as to whether they part ways with these people. We've seen mixed results at some of these talent agencies in particular. Both CAA and WME, arguably the two dominant power agencies, have both terminated agents over the past 3 months that were accused of groping male clients. In this case, at CAA, it was a male television executive. Now, besides being a kind of bizarre coincidence, that's examples of these agencies that acted, or at least were forced to act, when behavior was alleged. There have been other instances, though, at these talent agencies where people have been investigated for behavior, and then they have been cleared, either from an internal investigator or from an outside investigator. So it's not like you get an allegation against you and you're automatically gone. These companies are trying to do something to investigate, and it's just what that standard is a little bit opaque right now.
Yeah, and I will say in the case of WME, it took months and months, as I'm sure Terry Crews would attest, for them to finally let go of that agent. You know, one of the pieces I wrote that I think was very sensitive was these early complaints about Time's Up, where it was the question of how it was operating and who was invited was amorphous. And some people who really wanted to participate said, I wanted to do it, but I couldn't find out where and when the meetings were. And they were sort of responding without saying anything on the record. They had people saying, well, everybody's invited, which kind of goes in a circle. They just hired this woman, Lisa Borders, from the WNBA. And before that, she worked at Coca-Cola to be their executive director. And I think it's clear that for an organization like that to be effective and to speak with a voice promptly and address these matters, having somebody who is supposed to be in charge is critical. However, you know, I will say there's a lot of major talent in that, a lot of big stars like Reese Witherspoon and others. It's going to be a tricky thing to reconcile all the agendas and all the needs and wishes of all the people who are part of the Time's Up movement. At the same time, you know, it's a demanding thing to pay attention to this day in, day out, and you need somebody whose job it is to do that.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the larger conversation that's going on right now, not just about harassment in Hollywood, but also about equal pay and equal opportunities and the diversity question. And I do think that there have been big moves over the past year in all of those areas. You're seeing people getting called out for paying women different amounts than men make in the same job. And there is an effort being made, you see it in the fall TV shows this year, to put more inclusive actors in these major roles. And I think that is, while not directly related to the Weinstein scandal and all of that, I do think it's all connected and part of this awakening, for lack of a better word, that Hollywood has been under. And, you know, that in the past year, there's been pretty significant movement.
Yeah, I mean, we still don't see the representation that we would find anywhere close to equal, but maybe we will, I hope. I mean, I guess I would say a couple of things. I think another frontier will be generally abusive behavior, whether or not it's sexual misconduct, and whether that is going to be tolerated is a question to be dealt with. And I would say at this point still, we know that there are some open secrets in this town. And it's not that we don't want to report on them. It's that we have to have people come forward who can credibly make allegations if they want something done. So as long as that doesn't happen, as long as there's fear, or and maybe it's justified, but as long as that's the case, certain people will still sit in the seat of power. And they still haven't been budged. So we'll see where it goes. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new documentary, The Sentence, opens with a Michigan family hustling to get 6-year-old Autumn ready for her dance recital. Then the phone rings.
Hello.
This call is from a federal prison.
Hello?
Well, not yet. Hold on. Are you there? Okay. Here.
Hello, Mom.
Filming this scene is Autumn's uncle, Rudy Valdez. His sister Cindy, devoted mom of three very young girls, was just beginning a mandatory 15-year prison sentence on conspiracy charges related to drug crimes committed by her then-deceased ex-boyfriend years earlier. Cindy had completely changed her life, but the law was indifferent. In the sentence, Valdez follows his family through the years-long nightmare of his sister's sudden incarceration. Cindy's husband, Adam, as well as her parents, worked to raise Cindy's three daughters with as much connection to their mom as possible, through phone calls and occasional road trips from their home in Michigan to a prison in Illinois where Cindy is first incarcerated.
You girls, where are we going?
Mama.
All right. Where are we going, Annalise?
Oh, Mommy.
You
want
to see Mommy?
As time goes by, the strain of separation deepens, especially when Cindy is moved to a much more distant prison. Her brother calls her for an update.
Can you describe where you are now?
I'm in a federal prison camp in Coleman, Florida. It's 2011. The women's prison I was at in Pekin, they closed. I got moved here with 40 other women. I'm farthest from the girls. I mean, I'm seeing them like every 6 weeks. No, I'm not going to be able to see them at all.
For more than 9 years, Valdez kept his camera rolling as his nieces grew up, and he and his family desperately tried to find a way to shorten Cindy's prison term. The sentence premiered at Sundance this year, where it brought theatergoers to tears and won the Audience Award for Documentary. But when Valdez first started filming, awards and festivals were the furthest thing from his mind. So let's roll back to when this whole nightmare began for your family. Yeah. Where were you professionally? I mean, this was how many years ago?
So my sister was sentenced on February 29th of 2008. And at that point, professionally, I was sort of in limbo. I had been teaching kindergarten and was sort of transitioning out of that. I was an actor and a writer. And I was interested in production, but I didn't really, it was sort of something I was doing to, you know, just sort of fill the time creatively at that point.
What were you doing? For like, what kind of production?
PA. Grabbing coffee, right. Wrangling cords, and things stuff, like that. So I was living in New York City. I moved there to be an actor and quickly realized that that wasn't going to happen to me.
And, like so many before you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, I knew I was a storyteller, but I was just trying to figure out what that meant. When this happened to my sister, there was something, I don't know why I did it, but the day after she was sentenced, we were at her house, actually. She had been taken away. We didn't know where she was or where she was going. We were sort of in the dark. And I just picked up a camera that was there, and I started filming the girls. And it was something I guess was instinct. I told myself that it was important for me to film the girls because I didn't know at that point. I was still very naive as to what her sentence meant. I literally thought that there was a clerical error, that somebody was going to figure out that they made a mistake and that we were going to figure it out and she was going to come home.
So she's picked up how many years after?
So she was sentenced nearly 6 years after he was killed.
When she was indicted, did you guys immediately say she could be going away for a long time?
It was just interesting because all of a sudden we realized that it wasn't over. I think part of her getting her life back together and getting married and having the two kids and sort of living this life that she ultimately wanted to have, we're like, okay, she's moved on, and this part of her life has moved on. When she was indicted and the federal marshals came and got her, it was this weird feeling of, this isn't over. We didn't know what it meant. We were naive. We'd never gone through anything like that before. And we figured, like, even if she's found guilty, which she ultimately was by a jury under conspiracy laws, we thought, how could they send her away? What good does that do anybody? You know, she's clearly shown that she's changed her life. She's a contributing member of society. She's done what prison hopes to do, and that's to rehabilitate. And she was pregnant during this time. And so the judge said, well, we'll let you come back and report for sentencing after you've had your kid. And 6 weeks after, she goes in and reports for sentencing. And we were told that there were these mandatory minimums and there were these sentences that have been laid down for people. But even then, we thought, I don't understand how that could be, like how that could possibly happen.
Like maybe not in this case anyway.
Yeah, we thought that, you know, if anyone has shown why you shouldn't get that, it's my sister and who she is. And I remember hearing what the prosecution recommended her sentence be. And it was something like 89 years. based
just
on
for being present when all of this stuff was going down, not necessarily being a participant in any of it.
Yeah. So under these conspiracy laws, basically what happens is, you know, they figured these weights of the drugs that were moved throughout this drug ring over the years. According to those, their calculation was she deserved to be basically locked up for the rest of her life.
Right.
And the mandatory minimum of what she could get was 15 years. And that's what she was given. And the judge was basically like, this is what I have to give out. My hands are tied.
Now, were you the guy who took the family videos before that? Was that your role?
No, my sister took a lot of that. You know, she wanted to be a filmmaker when she was younger. And so I would be in some of the little things that she would make. And she actually, ironically, I don't know if this is funny or not, but she made a don't do drugs commercial when she was in high school.
That is ironic.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a little ironic. And I was in that and it was this whole thing. But so she just filmed a lot. A lot of the like home video stuff you see of the girls when they're really, really young is Cindy.
So then you find out that she's going to be away for, well, potentially 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, more than potentially, seemingly, certainly 15 years. And you start shooting the family thinking that you wanted to chronicle the kids as they grew up if she was going to miss all of that.
Exactly. If she was facing 15 years, I knew that we were going to show her pictures and that she was going to have phone calls during this time. But something in me said, I need to film the girls living. You know, I want her at some point when she comes out to be able to watch them run and ride a bike and birthdays. There's something about the moving image and the audio with it that invokes such emotion, and I wanted her to live that in some way, shape, or form. So that's what I set out to do originally.
And then at what point does the penny start to drop that this could be something else?
So it's unfortunate because of the circumstances, but it's interesting that I can pinpoint the exact moment that I became a filmmaker and that this became a documentary. I'd flown back to Michigan to film my oldest niece, Autumn's, first dance recital, a dance recital that my sister wanted to go to so badly.
And she was like six.
She was six, mm-hmm. 6 years old. And, you know, it's so interesting, like, thinking back on it, because I almost didn't go back. You know, I was living in New York at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like quite a bit. They were in Michigan, you were in New York. That's a commitment every time to go.
Yeah, and I certainly am not wealthy, and I was not wealthy at that time. So it was a big commitment to fly back. I remember booking the plane ticket, and it was something like $320, and I had like $500 in my account. You know, like it was a big decision
to
go back.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and so I go back, and I'm filming Autumn as she's getting ready for the dance recital, and completely unplanned, my sister calls, and it's the opening scene of the film. You know, she says this line to Autumn, and she says, "Do you know what Mommy's going to do when you go to dance?"
"What?"
"I'm going to lay down in my bed. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to think about you, okay, baby?"
"Hey."
"I love you so much. You have fun, okay?"
"Okay.
Love you."
And it sort of hit me all at once, you know, what was happening and what the sacrifice was, you know, and who was doing this sentence. I knew right then that I had an opportunity to tell a story that you don't normally get to see. When you read about mandatory minimum sentencing, when you read about this war on drugs, you're bombarded with these stats and the amount of people going away and the amount of drugs that are being taken off the street and the money and the guns and all these things. But what you don't take into consideration are the children, the families left behind and the communities that are left behind and who's really doing this time. You know, so I didn't know what it meant, but I said to myself, I'm going to figure out a way to tell this story. From that point on, I quit teaching, I quit acting, I quit writing, and I dove headfirst into documentary. So I became a PA, working on documentaries and commercials. And I literally bought Filmmaking for Dummies. I was going through it and trying to figure out what it all meant. And I turned that PA job eventually into a sound mixing job because I knew that I'm making this film on my own. I know how important sound is. And I wanted to be able to do that at the best of my ability. So I dove into sound mixing and I learned how to do that. And then eventually becoming an additional photographer on a Sundance series called Brick City. And turning that into a cinematography profession. And I went on to shoot films for Sebastian Younger and Sam Pollard and Whoopi Goldberg. And all of this driving me throughout these 9.5 years to dedicate my life to the craft of filmmaking and understanding it and understanding where my place was in it, all to make this film.
Well, so at what point did you say to the family, I mean, did you go to the husband first or the mom and dad, your mom and dad, or who, like, guess what? This is not just me making movies for my sister.
Yeah, I went to Adam first. You know, because
this is
dad. My sister's husband at the time. Yeah, the girl's father. I went to him first and I said, you know, we have an opportunity to tell a story. You know, and I said that to all of my family members with a promise to each and every one of them. I said, if you're open and you're honest and you're vulnerable and you let me tell this story, I promise you, I will make something good.
Coming up after a short break, filmmaker Rudy Valdez tells us about his mother's response when he told her his film had gotten into Sundance. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to documentary filmmaker Rudy Valdez. His film, The Sentence, will begin a small theatrical run on October 12th and will air on HBO on October 15th. The Sentence tells the story of Rudy's sister, Cindy, who was sentenced to a mandatory 15 years in federal prison on conspiracy charges related to drug crimes committed years earlier by her deceased ex-boyfriend. Valdez began the film to document the lives of Cindy's three young daughters so that she would one day have a record of her girls growing up. It evolved into a far more serious project. As her incarceration drags on, Cindy and Rudy's father tries to remain stoic, collecting and selling scrap metal to cover the expense of costly phone calls from the prison.
I mean, I just do the best I can to help her out in this situation.
Perfect.
Sure. I mean, I don't feel like saying much, but...
I know, Dad. I know it's hard.
That's why I don't write to her.
I remember looking down at the viewfinder and seeing him cry and thinking, you know, put the camera down, Rudy. Go and hug him. Go and tell him it's going to be all right. You know, be a good son. And something else started fighting me at the same time, and it kept saying to me in my head, hold your shot. Hold your shot. This is for the greater good. This is what you promised them. It's something bigger. And, you know, I'll never forget that because in some ways that's when I honed myself as a documentary filmmaker and really came in. And later on I realized those are the moments where I was sacrificing because I was creating this barrier between me and my family for the course of 9.5 years when they're going through all of this emotional turmoil and the things happening with my sister. Whenever I showed up, I had this barrier between us. So when things got really emotional like that, I had this mantra that would go through my head the entire time, and it would say, hold your shot. Are you in focus? Do you have enough battery? Do you have enough cards? Hold your shot. Are you in focus? You know, and just to separate myself, because if I was getting emotional behind the camera too much, I wouldn't be able to move and anticipate and tell this story. So,
and he never turned around and said, son, don't use that shot.
Never once.
Is there a point where you get financing for this, or are you just flying back and forth and living in New York or wherever the shows are taking you?
Yeah, so for 9.5 years, I worked to work. I worked on everybody else's film and everyone else's project to make this one. When, you know, the big ending comes, an amazing production company came on board, Park Pictures, and they helped me finish the film. They helped me get from post.
Did you pitch to them or?
No. So the funny thing about them is I met my producers, Sam and Jackie, who run Park Pictures. I was their daughter's pre-K teacher. all those years ago.
And okay.
And yeah, it's when I tell you, it's a long, but
didn't see that coming. But yeah. Good.
And so I remained friends with them. And again, I wasn't a filmmaker at this time, but Sam, who is my producer on this film and actually my composer on this film, was a musician. And my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, and I, we used to go and watch him play around New York City a lot, and we sort of kept in touch, and we became friends. And in a way, even though they weren't financing the film throughout, they knew when this happened to my sister, and they were this emotional support throughout the entire time. And they were part of the handful of people that actually showed a little bit of footage too throughout the years. So when this happened, you know, there were different producers and different people that knew I was working on this, and some offers came through from a lot of different angles. And Sam came to me and he said, look, we're here for you if you want. And they had actually offered early on to help me financially with the film. And I said, I can't take your money right now because I don't know where this film is going. And I didn't feel right taking money from somebody not knowing if I was going to be filming for 10 more years or when I was going to be able to deliver something to them. So as soon as I had an ending and I was ready to stop filming and edit this film, they were among the people who came to the drawing board. And I said, yes. Like, it was a no-brainer for me. It was family. And I'm the first documentary that Park Pictures is producing or has produced. And I asked for two things from them, the director credit and final cut. And Sam said, I believe in you. I believe in your storytelling. And we want you to make the film that you want to make.
You go, Sam.
Yeah, yeah.
You do find yourself at Sundance. At some point along the way, you figured out what that is.
Yeah, I did figure it out.
What was that like? I mean, your nieces were there.
Yeah, Sundance was, you know, first I got to tell you a quick story about my parents finding out about Sundance because it's pretty funny. Okay. I called my mom first. I think they have more of a clue now what I do for a living, but up until then, they didn't really understand what I did. And I called her and was like, Mom, the film got into Sundance. And she goes, oh, mijo, that's so great. Can we do it in New York? I love coming to New York. And I was like, well, I'll ask, but yeah, I think they're
I'll talk
pretty
to Robert Redford. Yeah,
I'll give old Bob Redford a call, but I think they're pretty stuck on Park City. And then I called my dad, and it was sort of a similar response. He was like, oh, great. That's
what's Sundance?
Congratulations. Right? And I hung up kind of thinking, like, I thought there'd be a bigger response, but okay, that's fine. And my sister actually called them and said, do you understand the gravity of what just happened? Of the odds of Rudy getting into Sundance, of making this film, just a guy in his camera for 9.5 years telling this small story. And she sort of let them know that, like, the amount of films that are submitted and that we got in and we got into competition, like all these things. And my dad called me back and he was crying.
Oh.
And he just kept saying, how did you know? How did you know? How did you know? And I said to him, I didn't know, Dad. I didn't know that anyone was ever going to see this film. I didn't know I was going to finish this film. I didn't know we were going to get into Sundance. But what I did know was all those years ago when this happened and I decided to make this a documentary, I knew that we as a family were about to face a very trying time and that we were going to get through it with grace and poise and love. And we were going to be very proud of how we came out on the other end. And I wanted to capture that. So we found ourselves at Sundance, you know. And, you know, I will say, obviously, I was ecstatic to get into Sundance and everything else that's happened with the film. But when we had our premiere and I got to invite my entire family up on stage and they saw this giant standing ovation at Sundance, and I looked at them. I looked at them. I didn't look at the audience because I was so grateful that they were able to see how their story is affecting people. And at that point, I didn't know what was going to happen after Sundance or what was going to go on, but there was the potential to truly make some change and make some good and fulfill that promise to them that we were going to make something good out of all of this. And it was wonderful to see them stand there with pride. And after being on the other side of this, you know, it was a moment I'll never forget.
Filmmaker and cinematographer Rudy Valdez is the director of The Sentence. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.